Welcome, everybody. I think we still have some people shuffling in, but we're about a minute past the half hour here, so we can get started. My name is Mike Weber, managing partner of Energy Infrastructure at Weber Research, as well as Armistice Street Capital Partners. And I'm here today to host Capital Link's webinar on the latest trends, opportunities, and outlook within the LNG market, which is part of their broader shipping and energy sector webinar series. You've probably seen a number of other calls come across your calendar the last couple of weeks. So with us today, we have Mr. Jerry Kalogiridis, from the CEO of Capital Clean Energy Partners, ticker CCEC. Mr. Knut Traholt, CFO of Flex LNG, ticker FLNG. Carl Fredrik Stabo, CEO of Golar, ticker GLNG. And Spiros Lioussis, CCO of Maren Gas Maritime. So a good mix today of both public LNG carrier owners, private LNG carrier owners, and reformed LNG carrier owners in Golar that are now in FLNG. So the webinar will feature a roundtable discussion with our panelists, followed by a Q&A session, and should run for roughly 45 minutes. Participants may submit questions at any time using the Q&A button on the webinar platform. We'll do our best to get to them during the Q&A segment. Nick, I may need to loop up with you on how to get those questions, but feel free to send them in. Please note that the questions should focus on the LNG sector primarily. We also note that these webinars are for informational and educational purposes only and do not constitute investment advice or any other form of advice. So we'll save everybody a full safe harbor there. Lastly, the webinar is being recorded Thursday, December 11th, 2025, and will be available later as an on-demand replay. So with that, I think we can get started. So like I mentioned, we have folks here that span the entire, almost the entire LNG liquefaction value chain, right? So from FLNG into carriers, and well, I don't know if there are any FSRUs owned within this group or at least where it's a primary business. I think everyone on this call has at least some familiarity there. So we'll primarily focus on liquefaction and LNG carriers. And so given that dynamic, I'm going to try to work from the top down from a value chain perspective. So starting with expectations on production, implications for carriers, and then kind of work on from there. So I want to start with the overarching theme for the LNG space for the next 4 or 5 years, which is the wave of production that's starting to hit now and should really hit between 2027, 2028, and as far out as 2030. Folks like us view that as potentially overbuilding on the liquefaction side. But the LNG carrier market looks like almost the perfect cosine kind of curve for the supply and demand dynamics, where the LNG freight market could look like it could get relatively tight during that period. As everyone here, at least on the panel, knows, LNG carriers are usually on time and projects are usually late. So I want to spend some time talking first on LNG capacity growth. I'm going to get into how the carriers are impacted, but first, I wanted to kick it to Carl. With Golar being involved certainly in FLNG for 15 years now, I guess going back to probably even before Cameroon. Just curious what opportunities you're seeing right now, and specifically, Golar's done a good job of looking at different sized assets, the original conversions, the Mark II, the Mark III, and there's a bit of a bifurcation in terms of kind of 2 MTPA projects up to 4 to 5. So Carl, a little bit of an overview in terms of what opportunities you're seeing there, how that would bifurcate in terms of at this stage in the cycle. Are you seeing 4 and 5 million ton opportunities? Are they smaller opportunities in the 2 and 3 million ton range? And then just your expectations for how much longer the capacity build-out could run.
Hi, Michael, and hi, everyone listening as well. So I think you touched on some very interesting points there. So when we started this year, the LNG market globally was around 430 million tons. And then in the course of the next 5 years, we expect to see another 200 or so being added. So almost a 50% growth of the overall market. What we find interesting is to break down where that supply comes from. So the world's largest single producer of LNG in the world today is the U.S. with a 20% market share or 100 million tons. Out of the 200 that's meant to come on stream in the next 5 years, 65% of that is meant to come from the U.S. So I think we're moving from a market which is driven mainly by demand, and you see JKM and TTF driving prices, to a market which I think to a large extent will be driven by international LNG prices by the incremental producer, which will be the US. The common denominator for all the US exports is that they're Henry Hub times 115% plus a tolling fee. In order to justify all of this build-out, you need to see tolling fees coming up for the infrastructure to be built. We also think that the supply-demand characteristics of Henry Hub speaks to a higher Henry Hub, and the forward curves agree. You basically see more than a doubling of exports, increased demand on the back of Trump's manufactured in the US, and demand from AI data centers. Hence, what we are trying to do as Golar is to identify attractive gas reserves that can be developed far cheaper than US volumes. Our business is relatively simple. It's got three cost drivers. It's the cost of the gas, it's the cost of liquefaction, and it's the shipping distance from where the gas is produced to where it's consumed. Golar today are actively working in West Africa and South America, where we're sourcing gas at fixed prices significantly south of both current and forward curves for Henry Hub. We construct incremental capacity at a 40% discount to US volumes, and we tend to have a shipping advantage from West Africa to Europe or from South America to Asia. Hence, if you're in a business driven by supply and you're way cheaper on all the three input factors, we think you have a very resilient business model, and that's where we see the potential. And that's why we see continued interest both from gas resource owners and for potential gas buyers to diversify away from US volumes and to still develop gas attractively.
Yeah, Carl, it's a good answer. And that was kind of the direction I was heading. That one of the things we've seen as we're in the latter innings of the supply build out, we've seen Total move out of NextDecade's Train 5, right? We've seen that they're being some potentially slowing momentum in the US Gulf. We might get one or two more. But there does seem to be interest in, say, another project in Northwest Canada. There is interest. I think Total's serious about Mozambique. Rovuma, probably not so much with Exxon. But are you starting to see that translate at all to folks looking for taking a 30, 40-year perspective and then looking for some diversity of length of haul and some geographical diversity? And I guess the way to ask that is, have you seen any shift in terms of the folks that are reaching out to you that you're discussing these projects with? Because there's a lot that goes into actually getting one of these FLNG projects done beyond simply the math working.
Yeah, I think the whole trick, as I said, is to develop the gas significantly cheaper than Henry Hub. And the good thing is Henry Hub is liquid and it's a forward curve, so there's quite good visibility on where that will be. And we know that the projects we're in discussions with can develop the gas sometimes at less than half the cost of that, or maybe even lower. So yes, that's interesting. And then on the demand side, we are seeing clients searching for non-US volumes. 10 days ago, the project we have in Argentina sold its first 2 million tons to Securing Energy for Europe. And that's part of their portfolio strategy and diversifying, obviously, away from Russia, but also not be single source US.
That's helpful. I want to pivot there to freight. And so we've spent a lot of time paying, covering the LNG build out. And while there's some debate and certainly some potential delays coming out of Qatar in terms of when that hits, it's definitely coming. And you're talking about a delta of maybe a year, right? And so I mentioned earlier that the freight curve almost looking a bit like a sine cosine relationship with liquefaction. So right around the time people like me get very worried about shut-ins in the US and overcapacity, Jerry, the freight market should be tightening pretty considerably. I know it's tight right now, which feels a bit like a short squeeze. How exposed is the LNG carrier market to those positive dynamics towards the end of the decade? And how do you see that playing out?
Hi, Mike, and good morning, everyone. Yeah, I think that the positive thing about shipping is that it's relatively LNG price agnostic, being more a floating pipeline going forward. And in an environment like this, where we have, first of all, this influx of new capacity that Carl described, the 200 new tons of liquefaction capacity, with most of it coming in the US, a number of projects still being discussed and close to FID. There is a lot of conjectures as to what happens to LNG price in Henry Hub, and you know, many opinions around how quickly demand will be, incremental demand will be generated by lower price, if we will be having enough natural gas, incremental natural gas production out of the US, so that Henry Hub does not really pick up materially. But in the end, shipping, as I said at the beginning, is relatively agnostic. We like volume. And the important thing is that this volume is coming, it's contracted. And even if you apply a relatively benign scenario, whereby you assume that most of that, those volumes will be, let's say, transported from the US to Europe, and you apply that historical 1.5 ship per MTPA multiplier, you come up with a number of 300 vessels that are going to be needed over the next 3 to 4 years. And that's before you take into account, for example, new FIDs, or if, for example, incremental demand comes from Southeast Asia, where probably that would increase the multiplier to closer to 3 ships per MTPA. So if you assume that half of that new capacity goes to Asia, then suddenly you don't have a need for 300 ships, you have for 400 ships. And if you look, actually, most analysts, they assume that demand is going to be somewhere around there, 300 to 400 ships. The other important bit, which is relates very specifically to shipping and not the LNG industry as a whole, is the structure of the fleet in the water. Unlike other shipping segments here, technologies are very different. The two-stroke 174,000 cubic vessel with real leak capacity and increased boil-off management capabilities is day and night compared to a steam turbine vessel, which has a very high consumption, small, can only carry smaller parcels, typically 135,000, 140,000, and has very limited trading flexibility. In the world of portfolio players, which is really what is dominating the LNG market today, everybody wants flexible, larger ships with good boil-off management. And this means that steam turbine vessels and, to a certain extent, TFDE vessels will exit the fleet. Already, we have seen record high scrapping this year with 15 vessels, and we have another 200 ships or so out there. Even if you assume that half of them exit the fleet at about the same pace that we have today, then you need to replace another 100 ships. So it is quite easy to see that we will be very quickly, and when I say quickly, over the next 1, 2 years, it's always very difficult to project in shipping into a shortage for ships. You know, the building capacity is pretty limited. There is a very emphasis is on Korean built ships, and Korea can produce 60, 65 ships maybe at most per year. So maybe we are at a point that around 2000, somewhere between 2028 to 2030, where we might not have enough tonnage. And that should drive spot rates significantly upwards. But it's also, I think, very much reflected in term charter rates.
Yeah, and it's a good point, Jerry. And that was actually the place I was going to go with this. And I'll throw this to Spiro. So with that shift in capacity, right, and the wave of new LNG coming online, are you starting to see that reflected to a greater degree in commercial conversations? And Jerry, it certainly sounds like we are already, to your point. But Spiro, how are you starting to see that reflected? Is it more interest in forward start, relook preferences? Are you starting to see people really plan ahead for what that market looks like in, call it, 28, 29, and 30?
Yeah, hi, Mike. Look, yeah, I think we have seen kind of recently a flare of, let's say, tender activity and a lot of charters coming in for securing their positions in 2028 and 2029. I still think this is a very small part of what the market will need. At that time, I think we haven't seen people with older ships, I think they're a bit reluctant to come in and replace. But yeah, I think we have seen that. Currently, as you said, I think it's difficult for a trader, for the shipping people in trading companies to justify a high number when the market is as soft as it was like during summertime when it was like in the 20s or 30s. And I think that kind of delays the decision-making process internally. And that means that they will be later coming in, and for us usually that's a good thing because everybody will come in at the same time. So I think that's kind of the trend that we are spotting, and we expect this to pick up a lot more like in the next couple of years.
Then along those lines, and can go to Newt now. In terms of what that market looks like from 28 to 29, and even kind of heading into it, I guess two questions. We've talked about projects have been delayed, and but that wave is coming, right? Everything's under construction. Who's building those projects, and how those vessels are actually employed matters quite a bit. If they're owned by, say, a sovereign or a state-backed entity. So one, like one of the some of our work certainly implies that the Qatari volumes is going to be late. Not to the point where it really dents the LNG carrier thesis, but certainly matters from a balance perspective. Do you see that those state-owned vessels coming into the market to compete on the spot side? I know everyone here has varying degrees of spot exposure, and your businesses are primarily long-term, but you do have periods of market exposure. So do you see, are there pockets of capacity that you see being a bit more resistant to or to stepping into and compete for shorter term merchant deals, say 3 to 5 years, because I know they're going to get called back for their by their state? And then as let me ask you that, and then I've got another follow up there in terms of contracting.
Just to let me kick to your previous questions on when charters are looking into lock in their commitments and seeing volumes for contracts for 29 and onwards. A year ago, we entered into an extension for startup in 29 for up to 10 years. So it's already there starting, and it depends a bit on charters what kind of volumes they're covering for. But I think it's also been mentioned there that there has been a new building wave. It's been a bit of a pause on it, but we do expect that that will kick in again, probably sometime next year. And with all these new ships required, there will be another new building boom. When you look at these more state-owned controlled ships, you're probably the most obvious one are the Qatari vessels. So historically, Qatar is not that active in the subletting space. So we don't see at the moment the full risk of these ships coming to compete in more in the sort of international deep sea market. One thing that could be of risk is that we understand from the Qatari contracts that there are some delayed startup options. That means is if those volumes are significantly delayed, Qatar can elect to delay the when they are starting the contract, leaving the ship owner open until they start with it. So then you might see some of those ships. But I guess that is more of a worst case scenario for that that the risk of those ships coming open.
Yeah, and certainly better than them being tethered to U.S. volumes, right? With say independent owners, right? The delay risk here is shifted from the U.S. to the bulk of the capacity coming out from Qatar, and at least that is more resistant to coming into the spot market. So my next question, and Knut, I'll ask this to you, and I can open up to the panel because I don't know that there is a definitive answer to this yet. But if I comp this cycle that to the last cycle and what we're heading into, it is going to look materially different. If you think about the last time we had a big wave of LNG capacity, there wasn't much merchant capacity, LNG capacity on the market, right? Cheniere with CMI, maybe some Freeport volumes or a cargo to Cameron. This time, by the time we're talking about the kind of the 27, 28 market, you're going to have significant merchant books at players I mentioned, a number of new players, and then you're going to have projects where they could be running multi-year commissioning programs. You could have projects like Woodside that are at 3, 4 million tons contracted, right? So you could have it's just going to look a lot different. There's going to be a lot more merchant capacity to chew through. And then there's also the possibility that it's punctuated with some pockets of balance sheet risk that you didn't really have last cycle. So I'm curious, have you guys formalized any internal thoughts yet on what that should look like, and how the contracting environment should evolve in that kind of market where you've got maybe say softer global LNG prices, not enough freight, but big merchant books to chew through before you get to term volumes?
I guess you would say between the different players, you mentioned Woodside that have a lot of uncovered capacity. They will probably be more sort of flexible on when they're doing shut-ins if you have this a massive drop in the natural gas prices. Most of the other players, they have been sort of at a conservative approach of securing a lot of offtake SPA volumes. So that they can withstand it slightly longer. So I think it's more interesting to see that Woodside have elected to call it a more aggressive charter or contracting policy than what's been usual in the
Yeah.
industry.
And maybe Jerry, I'll put this to you, just in terms of the impact on freight, right? And maybe the question is like, do you care? Outside of maybe the pockets of balance sheet risk that I know you guys spend a lot of time looking at, and for the most part, LNG is an investment grade business, right? In terms of counterparties, or as close to it as you get in shipping, right? Do you think that shifting dynamic, at least from a liquefaction perspective, has any impact on carriers and the chartering environment?
A couple of thoughts here. I think firstly, the tolling fee structure means that in theory, the liquefaction operator shouldn't be that affected if there were to be shut-ins, right? I mean, they would still collect the fee. And it also, the operational capabilities or rather structure of a liquefaction train means that it's not easy to switch them on and off, just for a day or two. So if, for example, we have a seasonal lull in the summer where potentially customers don't want to off-takers, right, don't pick up the cargo, it doesn't mean that that cargo gets lost and it will be shut in, because really the liquefaction operator will have to take a pretty large decision with regard to shutting a whole train. So we might see those cargoes not being picked up by their contracted offtaker if they are, just waiving their right, but we might still see them coming to the market. And that's what I meant originally when I said we are not that price sensitive. I mean, this business is like the volume. So
You don't care, yeah. Yeah.
if those cargoes still come to the market, we're still picking them up. The only thing that you need is, in the end, there is like people have to still be able to make money, right? How cheap does that cargo go so that if you add shipping on top and regasification can be effectively sold? So that's one thing. So we might see very cheap cargoes coming, but still ships were going to be needed. To your question, I think with regard to the much larger merchant fleet, I think what has created and probably we'll see more of that is what we see today. So in a market where project vessels do not have a project or are not being used, then they're being relet in the market, and then you have a lot of pressure. But also in a market which is very tight, immediately that those ships, like the one we're experiencing over the last couple of months, they disappear immediately because projects need them. So we might see, I think what the larger fleet might bring is more volatility in rates whenever there is a lot of reletting of ships. But then again, very tight spots.
So it's going to be interesting. I want to stay on that topic for a little bit, or just what the environment's going to look like, and maybe I'll go to Spiro here before going back to Carl and something. But through the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen both the average size of LNG carriers start inching up, kind of from 170, 174 to 180K, 200K delivering. At the same time, you've also seen, obviously, reliq subcoolers, air loop systems becoming almost standard in terms of latest gen carriers. So my question is twofold. What's driving the ramp in size, right? Because obviously, ultimately, you need the cargo lots to line up. So is that, in what way is that being driven by the producers? But then also in terms of the premium that's potentially assigned to that modern tonnage with Rielec subcoolers or air like or air lube lubrication systems, do you see that premium widening out as we move into an environment where there is abundant production, floating storage or demurrage could matter quite a bit more? Do you think that is that premium already reflected in terms of interim rate, or do you think that there's more to go in terms of how it could widen?
Look, I think on term rates, it's definitely reflected, and it has to do with unit freight cost calculation. I would say the premium is more relevant to the, it's more sensitive. It's the only thing that actually is sensitive to the price of LNG, because effectively that's what's affected. That, if you have Rielec or if you have a more efficient ship, you are burning less LNG, so you are able to deliver more cargo. So at the end of the day, you have a better unit freight cost. So I think that's where you will see the premium more. I would say if you see a very soft LNG market, you could see that premium kind of softening, like I'm being squeezed between, let's say, DFDEs and two strokes. But I think the value of two strokes is still there. And also, if you account for environmental restrictions in the EU and potentially, some kind of IMO net zero framework coming online, I think that will be probably amplified. And just to add also a couple of points on thoughts, like on the previous, like on the, I think what you were asking. On the more, let's say, merchant volumes coming online, our view is that there will be a higher demand on short term, like medium term structures. A project when it has like a 10-year SPA, they will try to do back to back with the SPA. But in this case, if you don't have a specific SPA or you don't have a specific destination for your LNG, you will try to keep like shorter positions, like 2, 3, 5 year positions. So I think that's probably the shift that we will be seeing a bit more. And this goes together with the increase in the fleet size. So as you see the fleet size increasing, you see like a more the different segments of periods, let's say for the time charters also increasing. So a bit more liquid in both spot and like short-term charters.
Yeah, a bit more of a shift to try to get more variable costs in there versus fixed. Yeah, that makes sense. I have a couple more technical questions I'm going to skip over just in the interest of time. And I wanted to move to end user demand and the geopolitical environment. And I'll go to Carl with this one. And so this is something we're hearing a lot of. We started hearing about more at Gastech when there was some noise around, say, Power-Siberia 2 and what does it do to the demand sinks that I think the industry tends to lean on. Obviously, you've got the really robust European sink, which is being serviced increasingly out of the US Gulf. But then when you look at the wave of capacity coming online, the Chinese and the Indians and a handful of other markets would need to step up to take that volume, and they're historically relatively opportunistic. Carl, is there one demand sink that you think could surprise to the upside? Obviously, the Chinese have not. I think their imports are up for the first time in almost a year now. But still relatively light. Is there one demand sink that you think could surprise to the upside from here over the next couple of years?
I think it has to do with the relative pricing of LNG versus alternative fuels, and I think the ones that has shown that the most is China. So if the price comes to a level where it's cheaper than the alternatives, mainly Brent and coal, they'll switch. You've seen it happen many times before, and it will happen again. So I think that goes in particular for China, but a lot of the Far East in total. And you have other by volume, maybe not as large, but you have a significant part of the merchant fleet, both on container cruise and also increasingly on commodity ships like tankers and some bulkers that now have dual fuel as well. Today, all of them are effectively running on low sulfur heavy fuel oil, but the minute that shift swings, then they will all go on LNG. So for me, it's more price, relative pricing than it is one specific center because energy demand is there and it's increasing. And the minute it's more cheaper, you'll go there.
And if I may, to Carl's point, if suddenly China comes back to the market and, for example, starts importing more US LNG, that could be a tremendous catalyst for shipping, right? As we said earlier on, I mean, multiplier immediately almost doubles, so supply of ships shrinks. So it's quite a volatile environment, I think, going forward. And pricing changes and what that didn't make does for demand could materially affect and very quickly what happens to shipping as well.
Yeah, at varying points, you're going to run into elasticity restrictions, if you will, in some of those markets. Certainly in China, when you start talking about power, and certainly in India, when you think about inland infrastructure and other markets. One of the areas that we haven't touched on yet would be LNG bunkering as a potential demand sink. And I can just throw this out to the broader panel if anyone wants to take it. If I think about the last 10 years for LNG bunkering, it was really in its kind of nascent stages. You have some small businesses, like Shell's got that business on the Atlantic coast. You've got, the order book ramped, but there are frictions associated with getting that kind of infrastructure in place, just like there are for opening up new LNG markets. How do you think the next 10 years look for LNG bunkering relative to the previous 10? And do you think it can actually become a meaningful demand sink? And I can throw that out to anyone.
I can start because I already touched upon it, the fact that you have so many more ships now on dual fuel, right? So already 10 years ago, there was very, very few ships that needed LNG bunkering, and thereby the cost of the operations itself became inefficient, especially for LNG bunkering ships. Now it's a very, very different situation. You have the majority of new container vessels built with dual fuel, and you have several other vessel classes. The advantage with the vessel classes, including containers now built on dual fuel, is that you know exactly where they will go because they follow their line, right? So to cater for a bunkering infrastructure along those already known geographical points is a lot easier than it was 10 years ago. And the volume that the market you cater to is far larger. Hence, the unit economics to provide bunkering service, we think, is completely different in the market today than what it was 10 years ago.
Yeah, and if I may add, I mean, we, the Capital Group, is trading spot dual fuel LNG tankers. And every day, every time that bunkering comes up, we run the sensitivity. Does it make sense, or it does, or it does? So the moment that turns green, because really we have a very nice tool which recommends LNG bunkering or not, taking into account all parameters. Because, I mean, having said that, it is a lot more complicated than simply picking up fuel oil. I think we all have to admit that. Cooling down tanks, the time, the stemming, the notice. But the moment that you can do that and the difference becomes meaningful, then you turn into LNG. And I think, multiply that across different segments. I mean, not just shipping. I mean, across industries, and this is how it works. Yes, there are bottlenecks. For example, in shipping, we do need more LNG bunkering barges, which are now being built. There has been a material pickup in ordering. We need a more alive market, let's say, for tram shipping, so that you can have the incremental demand, not just from containers that go A to B, but also from spot tankers or other spot types of ships. But I think this is very much coming. All players are looking at how to make the best of their dual fuel LNG assets. And I'm sure as soon as that price turns, you will see that the demand pick up.
I want to shift now to geopolitical risk. I think I'm the only one on this call that's based in the U.S., which is great because there's no volatility here. It's totally calm. It's obviously a relatively volatile period. I mentioned PS2 already. You've got Russia, Ukraine, Trump, tariff policies, et cetera. So maybe go around the panel here, start with Spiro. What's the one geopolitical variable that would keep you up at night if you think about the next handful of years? It has a, the most likely to have a material ramification for the LNG carrier market.
I would say that's U.S.-China relationships. I think that's clear, because if China has, I think the way we see the world is that China will be a big sink for LNG. I think our ships have commissioned 7 LNG regasification terminals in China in the last year and a half. So they have built up a lot of capacity to import, to take LNG in. So effectively, if there is some kind of, as it started being, and then it froze a few months back, if we start seeing like China not taking LNG cargoes from the US, I think that would be a significant, let's say, downside on in our business. I think all the rest are probably, they would work towards the freight market, probably.
Yeah, work in their favor. Okay. Knut, anything on your end?
No, I fully agree. US-China relationships is by far the biggest risk if there is escalation in that. I think over the last 5 years we have been through pandemic, war in Ukraine, war in Gaza. It hasn't really kept us awake at night, but a worsening in the trade relations or the trade war between U.S. and China is there. It definitely. It's all sort of the small piece of that. It started off with the USTR in the U.S. LNG tankers are exempted for that, so probably the LNG ship owners were more relaxed than others segments. And then obviously with the port fees in China introduced there, I guess most of us has been through on AI language models to understand exactly what that port entry form means. So
You probably got four different answers.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So but a more serious trade war, an escalation of that US or China as a destination of LNG is super important long term.
Carl?
What we are involved with, which is production of gas, US, China, obviously, but I would just US only. What happens in the US? And I think it's very Henry Hub sensitive. It's only a year ago since the Biden administration put the ban on incremental exports. And what I see now is if you're going to more than double exports and increase domestic demand for Henry Hub, and there's no real supply of gas, you'll see higher energy prices in the US, and that might impact the motivation to export. So for us, either you keep these exports and then we believe the price will be put higher, or there will be some sort of a limitation on how the volumes will go, whether regulatory or just as a function of price. And then the call on non-US gas will be higher, or non-US LNG will be higher.
So you're
So,
talking about the risk of a future administration curtailing some of the
yeah,
crude opening, yeah.
either by curtailing by regulation or curtailing because the price comes to a level where the interest in export is not there.
People
Is
in the
that
US
Henry
like to
Hub?
forget that we pay a third of what Europeans pay for gas. Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead, Knut.
No, if that Henry Hub, as I follow on that, if that Henry Hub stays too high, and suddenly that becomes the political pressure even on the current administration, that you need to limit export to push down Henry Hub prices and for the voters for the next year's elections. So when we say US-China relationship, but China is retaliatory to US, I fully agree with Carl. It's primarily US risk.
I
So
agree.
another way to put that would be the midstream and the upstream in the US keeping up with the liquefaction growth so that you don't see $7, $8 Henry Hub.
Correct.
Yeah.
And we don't see that. No.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I think that the upstream is there, but the midstream has been struggling to keep up. Jerry, anything on your end? Anything? What's the one geopolitical risk that you would say could potentially keep you up at night for the next couple of years?
Well, I don't think I disagree with my fellow panelists. I think that's probably the bigger one. I would just maybe flag another development, which I think could be a net positive for LNG shipping, which is the potential end to the Ukraine-Russia war. Right now, Russian LNG has been exports have been limited by sanctions as well as by limited uptake. There has been China has been really the only market, and it potentially also the new pipeline linking Russia and China for the export of natural gas. But Russia really would prefer to have more options, and LNG gives you options, right? So if at some point there is a peace agreement, and I'm pretty sure that part of that peace agreement, the Russians will bring energy exports on the table, then suddenly you have, including new projects, like the Raskem Alliance project, you have maybe another 50 MTPA that come very quickly to the market. And these projects, they're going to need ships. And right now, this is completely discounted. So I think that's an additional positive one that could come from geopolitics. But in the end, I fully agree. What China does, China-US relations, potential conflict in Asia Pacific, all that could change the world significantly.
So, Jerry, that's an interesting point. So, I mentioned Paris-Siberia too early a couple of times already, and it's a bit of my boogeyman. But, linking that to a continued conflict, the Russians leaning closer to China and then setting up, they've already ramped throughput through Paris-Siberia 1, but Paris-Siberia 2 would obviously be a long-term commitment, right? That that limits their options. You would tether those two together, right? In terms of either we get one potentially or we get the other, right? So if you get a peace agreement, the Russians have not been able to add capacity for quite a while now, and we would expect as well that they would really put the pedal down, and with that, with infrastructure that would give them flexibility. So I'm curious, when you guys think about supply dynamics or capacity dynamics for LNG, out in the 2030, 2031, do your models reflect one of those two scenarios, right? Either the doubling of pipeline gas to China or four or five new Russian projects, maybe not four or five, maybe two or three, right? They're spurred from this peace agreement. In one way or shape or form, they've been absent from the market for what, 5, 6 years now, or maybe not quite that long, 4 or 5 years now.
Yeah,
Is
look.
that something you guys view as inevitable?
Yeah, I think one of that maybe both will happen. I think for Russia it's important to build. I think from their point of view as well, it's important to build alternative markets. I think the Ukraine situation proves to them as well that they need LNG, and LNG is ideal for that. I think on the power Siberia too, the Chinese are building redundancy in the system, and they're building strategic alternatives. I don't think they want to be reliant on any single supplier. And I was telling before, like the regasification capacity they have commissioned the last year is power Siberia 2 capacity. Like, it matches the number. So, I think they are just building optionality in their system, and they will be able to pressure prices for sure. Remember, like China has 60% of the internal consumption comes from local gas production, Chinese gas production. And Chinese gas production generally is quite expensive. And if that comes down below $10 per MBTU, I think they should be keen to replace that and keep it for more expensive periods with either Russian or LNG coming online. And as Jerry said previously, we see Russia coming in with new liquefaction projects for sure.
The one thing I would flag there is the funding for Arctic 2 actually got rejected by the Russian parliament, and they had to dip into their sovereign wealth fund to pay for it. So they may want to do a lot of that stuff, but do they actually have the capital to do probably two or three very expensive liquefaction projects as well as a pipe? It's going to be interesting. We're just about out of time. I have some questions on residual values and secondhand values, but 30 seconds away from time, so I'll save that. And so we can move to any questions from the line. And it looks like I do have a number of questions here. All right, so we can start chewing through these instead. I'll throw these out to the broader group. With energy prices where they are today, how confident are you there will be enough gas output in the US to fully utilize the coming liquefaction capacity? We kind of touched on this already, but confidence level out of 10. Anybody want to throw it out there that we'll have enough upstream capacity and midstream capacity to match that liquefaction capacity?
I'm quite confident. I think there will be. I think most of the gas today is associated gas. There are a lot of gas reserves in the US, and the cost of extracting that gas is coming down. So I don't think. And talking back to our US friends, I think that's a point to, put EQT or whoever else, big producers in the US. I think they are quite confident that they can ramp up production.
Okay, there's actually a very thoughtful question here on LNG carrier supply demand dynamics and shut-ins, but I think we've already touched on that. Okay, good. Here's one on asset values. What are your projections for new build prices over the next few years? Additionally, when do you expect shipyard slots for deliveries beyond 2029 and potentially into the early 2030s and beyond to start getting filled? Throw that to Knut and then maybe Jerry.
Yeah, so for new building and slots, 28 is more or less fully booked now. So we're already starting now to fill up 29 slots, and that would probably take it's more or less now a 3 year lead time on ordering and delivery. So that will, but if you want to have a ship in 28, it's there are not many slots left.
Yeah, no,
Anyone
I
else?
absolutely agree. There is little to almost nothing left for 28. And if I was to make a guess, I think within the first half of 26, we will see a significant portion of 2029 being booked as well. They are, we discussed it early on, right? I mean, there are so many uncovered inquiries and volumes, and people have been waiting to see where the long-term market does, where new building prices go. I think overall, we saw new building prices come down by maybe less than 5%. And already, I think we touched bottom, and we see now prices moving up. Probably we are, let's say, around the $250 million range, plus or minus, depending on spec today. So I think it won't be long, 6 to 12 months before we see prices creep up again to north of 260, and potentially a tight market. There is the added complexity that USTR and that brought in, and the whole US administration turn towards US-built ships. While USTR does not apply to LNG carriers in the same way, I think you will find very few US liquefaction operators, for example, that would be willing to take a Chinese vessel today. So then this means that part of the supply is not there for a big part of the market. They will say they will always focus on Korean ships. So automatically, demand is there, supply is less. So you should see prices moving up.
It's helpful. Anybody else?
Just to
All
add
right, a
on to
couple.
that, there are plenty of arguments for new building prices moving up, and I think you see the yards, they also see the same statistics, and they are expecting more ships to be ordered, so they are incentivized to keep the yard prices up, and the same for the GTT as the cargo containment system provider. They're also seeing the need for more ships, and they have all the incentives to push prices up.
And I
So
think
I'll
the shipyards for once have a lot of confidence now, so they won't give
Yeah.
up as easy and roll over as they
Right.
did 4 or 5 years ago.
So I'll ask one on the back of that, right? Because like elevated asset values is generally good for everybody in this panel, right? Because it's going to be helpful for NAVs. But that assumes obviously a relatively linear asset curve. If you've got upward pressure on new build prices, and you've got a wave of supply coming online that probably favors relic. How do you think that if I think about the asset curve, is there a pocket of on that age curve? If you were to look at secondhand vessels, which I know is notoriously thin, is there a pocket or an age spread there that you think looks particularly attractive without giving away any future trade? Maybe go to Sphera first.
Yeah. Look, I mean, as you said, it's a pretty thin market. I mean,
Yeah, it's a
there.
theoretical exercise, unfortunately, but yeah.
I think like it would be difficult to make a decision to buy a DFDE right now unless you need to have a very compelling price. And I don't think you can get a good price for a two-stroke. Even like a 7, 8 year-old two-stroke, I still think it would be. There are only a few two-strokes without relic. I think yeah, like a standard description of two-stroke, I think okay, who would be buyers? I'm sure, like all
Right.
everyone here,
Everybody.
cargo would be buyers for the vessels, but they're not out there. I mean, there aren't a lot out there.
So that asset curve, the value curve would, the decline would steepen pretty hard, right, at the technology cutoff.
I think the difference, the delta is quite significant. I expect, the delta between, you don't have buyers on the DFDEs and you don't have sellers on the two strokes. So the market prices for those, I think it's quite, they are quite, it's a quite different price, quite different exercise. And for the two strokes, since we haven't seen any new technology coming in and nothing really significant that will change the board like it did before with between DFDEs and two strokes, I think the relative values for the two strokes will remain quite high, probably correlated to their shipbuilding prices and then like a linear depreciation versus the lifetime of the asset.
Anybody else?
I think on the dual fuel and the tri-fuels, you eventually will start to see this build-out of import capacity again. And if you have the right size, the larger tri-fuels and dual fuels, one of the buyers would be for import projects and FSRU conversion.
That
And that
ties into one of the
might,
questions of, yeah.
and that might also keep those asset values on the tri-fuels elevated. Because once you have that project, they're also willing buyers on it.
Yeah, we did get a question in the chat on the future of the FSRU market versus regas terminals. I'm trying to think of a good way to ask this, but do you see more future regas capacity growth coming from, call it EM, FSRUs opening up new markets, or do you see it being coming from land-based terminals?
I think you will see land-based terminals now being built out in Europe that will free up some of the FSRUs that are locked in there. Once you see natural gas prices coming down, and we touched into the demand elasticity, but then you will see more demand coming from Southeast Asia, from China, probably more emerging markets for the FSRU market, but first you need to see more long-term stable, lower natural gas prices.
That makes sense. Land-based first, then when you have a price point that can displace diesel power gen or what have you, then you start seeing the build-out of the
Remember, the land-based terminals are that's big infrastructure projects, and it takes time. With an FSRU, you can deploy them fairly quickly, and at a lower cost.
Two more here, and they should be quick. Isn't China slash Taiwan a perhaps? I think they mean perhaps the most important geopolitical variable. Now, I don't think anybody here was willing to die on the hill of what the most important geopolitical variable is, but maybe anyone's thoughts on the implications for China, Taiwan, and LNG shipping. I mean, I guess if there was going to be a war that everyone got dragged into, that would have a long-ranging impact that we would have struggled to get our arms around. But does anyone have anything they want to say on that?
Yeah, I would just put it in the, I mean, when we say US-China relationship, that comes in as well, obviously, and but that could be more of an extreme scenario. Again, this is now wild conjecture, but that could probably make the split between West and East more acute. China importing only from certain nations, possibly not from the US. So more Middle Eastern Gulf focused rather, or other Africa projects maybe rather than the US or Australia. But typically, of course, you can try to guess how trading patterns come together. But I think typically inefficiencies like this are good for shipping. When you don't have optimized, if you don't allow for optimization of the movement of cargoes, typically you see better shipping markets. But that's just the nature of the business.
It's two more actually. We had one just come in and then we're going to cut it off. But I think I get that. Any uncommitted orders that the panelists are willing to make, bet on the spot. I think what they're getting at is that would you guys go out and take exposed tonnage right now that you didn't have to, or would you wait?
Think
Place an order on spec and not look for a charter?
Nurse, I think all of us are, we don't order against projects. We order on speculation and then we fix during the construction
Yeah.
period. So I think we have, I know Jerry has. So yeah, I think there are, we have ships, like we have ships uncommitted in the new, in the in our order book. I think it depends on the risk profile of everyone, how many of those you can digest. I think that's it.
Agreed,
We've
definitely.
also proven to do that in the FLNG market. So I think
Yeah, absolutely.
when the chemistry, when you have
Yeah.
enough candidates looking for a project, you create
Slightly,
the by placing your.
slightly bigger speculative bet there, I would say, but from a capital perspective. But
We can discuss how speculative it really is, but I
yeah.
agree.
Yeah. Well, I like to tell people nobody has significant spot capacity in the LNG market on purpose for the most part. Maybe a little bit here
No,
and there, but go ahead.
I can give some color on from Flex side. So our consideration for that is that if we order on speculations, then we are also competing against our own open ships that comes in 28, 29. So doing a new building order at $250 million, you're probably to get the best price need to maybe order two, with the option for another two ships. It's a big capital commitment, and with the current sort of long-term 10-year rates that will cover a new building, we find that risk a bit too high. So that's why we've been reluctant to be sort of active in that new building order market.
That makes sense. Last one here, then we'll stop for the day, and it's a fun one. Any chance of US flagships? And so I hear a lot about this, and I know there's been a big push, and Hanwha and some other folks are involved. So whether it's really built in the US and Jones Act compliant by the letter of the law, is there any interest on your end, provided that there is a mechanism for which you could flag something with a US-based sub? Do you think that's a real, obviously it's not going to materially impact, carrier supply demand dynamics, because there's no way we're talking about more than a few, if that, but like the, is it meaningful for your end, and do you think we actually see it happen?
US built, I don't think. Yeah,
Sorry,
go ahead.
Mike, go ahead.
No, that was the only comment. I don't think we'll see US built. US flagged, who knows? If it's a policy, do it, maybe, but US built, no.
I think so as well. I think it's going to be very difficult. If we're talking about, US built, I think might have a different definition in a few years. Maybe that would mean some engineering is done in the US or part of the outfitting, and that might happen. I think all the efforts are in that direction. I don't think anybody has illusions that suddenly, in 2 3 years from now, US shipyards will start spitting out LNG carriers. Then, US flagged again, in theory, easier as they don't have to be built in the US, but they will have to be manned by US crews and they need US ownership, which is, I mean, none, I think, of the people on this panel have that to that extent. And maybe you can fix in, but the bottleneck there is US crews. I think it's very difficult to find US crews in general, and even more so trained for the LNG business. There's definitely a bottleneck there. We understand that the administration is again looking for solutions. But again, just like the ships, maybe the solution would be a mix of, like probably ships might be built in Korea and finished in the US. You might have a mix of US crews and international experienced crews that create that pool of seafarers that are needed to man US vessels. But that, still we are at a very nascent stage, I think.
Okay, well, I think I just got a proper commercial inquiry in the chat, so that's probably the time to turn it off. I'll forward it over to you guys. But I appreciate everybody's time. It's been a great call. We ran a little bit over. And I want to thank Nick and Capital Link, as well as everyone who joined us on the line for today's LNG panel. But with that, I think we can end for the day. Thank you guys once again.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you,
Thank
everyone.
you.